scripture reading this morning is coming from Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Right.
I think we are going to have to cut the PowerPoint off because that's the wrong sermon that I preached a few weeks ago. And I don't think y'all want to hear the same sermon again, do you? So you can just shutter it on that remote and go to the song, which will not be a problem because most of the things I'll be saying, the PowerPoint wasn't that extensive anyways. I want us to be thinking in our series on the church about what the church is. We talked about our purpose. We've talked about our duty to equip, to minister. And then this morning, we want to talk about our identity as the family of God. Who are you? How do you identify yourself? Much of our identity comes through our family. Alice Plutek was a lady living in Vancouver, Washington, and she wanted to do a fun DNA sample test. Some of you might have done those through Ancestry.com or 23andMe.com. You take some saliva and mail that in, and they tell you about your DNA, and they tell you about your family history. And she thought that she had a pretty good understanding of her family history. She thought that she was Irish Catholic. She had grown up in the Bronx, and her family was strongly Irish and strongly Catholic. That was their identity. When she got back her test about 5 years ago, she realized that there must have been a big mistake, she thought, because it said part of her ancestry was what she was expecting because it was on her mother's side. But then her other half was Russian Jew. Russian Jew. Comes from the Eastern Orthodox, kind of Eastern Bloc countries, and was a Jew. And she thought, I've never heard anything about Jewish blood, and certainly not 50% Jewish. And so she was puzzled, and she thought, she wrote them a nasty letter and said, y'all must have this all wrong. And so she then did another test, and she had her sister do a test, and she got to investigate, and she actually had six brothers and sisters, and she got them involved, and guess what? There wasn't an affair. There wasn't any kind of adoption, which she had first suspected. She thought, maybe I'm not really, wasn't who I thought. Maybe I was adopted, or maybe my dad wasn't really my dad. And she went through all these scenarios. She found out that she was completely brother and sister with all of her siblings. But all of them who thought their whole life they were Irish Catholic, all of them had half Jewish blood in them. And it wasn't that bothered them in per se that they were racist. It was just that they were confused and they were puzzled at how they could have this identity. And it really made them question everything about what they'd been taught and who they were. So they had to get to the bottom of it. So she begins to research, and she has everybody she can, cousins and others, fill out these DNA samples, and she goes through a process. And finally, after several years and spending as almost a full-time job, full-time job on this, that is Alice, and that's her brothers and sisters, and this was her father right here. And she is trying to research her father, Jim Collins. And finally, they were able to prove. They go back and they are researching the birth records in 1913 in a Bronx hospital. And they go through all the Jewish names and they're trying to figure out maybe they were swapped at birth. Hit a dead end on everything. Until finally, another DNA sample connected it with a cousin of someone. And they got to talking. And they were able to figure out that, yes, it was indeed. They were swapped at birth. Another baby to a Jewish family, an Eastern or Russian Jewish descendant, was born similar time at that hospital. And his name was Philip Benson. And the babies had been swapped. He was born to the Irish Catholic family and looked very much like them. And she said it was odd in our family because we always thought Dad just didn't look like the rest of us. And even looking at all the pictures, he looked different than all the other ancestors. And he had actually spent some time in an orphanage because his mom had passed and the dad had to give up the children to be provided for in the orphanage. And so they thought maybe something happened with the orphanage. What really happened was, in this hospital in Bronx, New York, they were switched at birth in 1913. Now what's interesting and fascinating about this story is that you have this concept here of a man who was born into a strongly Irish Catholic family and that identity. He struggled. It said that as he grew up in an orphanage, his life, he didn't know much about his parents, never knew his mom. His dad basically didn't have anything to do with him after he had gone to the orphanage. But he always knew his key identifying trait was that he was Irish and that he was Catholic in his religion. That was how he had defined himself. And then this other man, of course, Philip Benson, he grew up understanding that he was Catholic or Jewish, Eastern Jew in his identity. But actually, biologically, of course, they were swapped. They should have lived different lives. And now this mystery, both men were deceased. And the family's talking about, would we tell our dad? Would we tell him if he was still alive? That his whole life, his identity about really who he was had been wrong? Now here's the point I want you to get from this story. And it's an interesting story, obviously. But I think it makes a good point. Is that your identity shapes your beliefs. Your identity shapes your beliefs. We can see this very clearly in this illustration that the Jewish man who actually biologically was Irish but was raised his entire life believing he was an Eastern Russian descending Jewish person. And it shaped his life, and he was proudly Jewish. And another man, who was actually biologically a Jewish man, spent his whole life believing and went to his death believing he was an Irish Catholic. Now the question I want to ask you is, how do you identify yourself? Because it will shape your beliefs. It will shape how you interact with others. And what you think about your faith. And what I want to suggest to you this morning is that each of us, and what's important for us as Christians, is to identify ourselves as a part of God's family. That is, we are in God's family. And when the Bible speaks of this, it uses this terminology often, and that this identifying trait should go through everything, that we should see ourselves as the family of God. For example, in the Bible, in the New Testament, the term Father is used 250 times to describe God as our Father. The term children, in referring to Christians being God's children, is used 20 times in the New Testament. And the terms brothers and sisters, brethren in Christ, is used 99 times in the New Testament. One of the key analogies for what Christians are in the New Testament is that we are a part of the family of God. When you read numerous New Testament passages, it's going to talk about this. But Jesus will spend a lot of time talking about this himself. Look in Matthew chapter 12, verse 46. While he was still speaking to the people, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside and asking to speak to him. But he replied to the man who told him, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" Stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers, For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and my sister and my mother. Notice that Jesus prioritizes the spiritual dimension of the family of God above the biological dimension of our families. He says that whoever does the will of my Father, that is my brother, my sister, and my mother. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus will say similarly in verses 34 through 39 that we ought to prioritize our relationship with Christ above even our biological family. He says, verse 34, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace on the earth, for I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Jesus says, I've got to be top priority. That he's going to divide families even in how they decide their loyalty and allegiance to him. He says, verse 36, "For whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." You see, Christ clearly understood that he's saying, I'm building a spiritual household. The New Testament will talk about this in other passages. For example, in Ephesians chapter 2, it talks about the household of God, which is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. In 1 Timothy 3:15, "That you may know how to conduct yourself in the household of God." The church is the household of God. It's God's family. And it is to take priority even over our own family. In Romans 8, he says that we are adopted as Christians into this family. That is that we're not born into this family per se by natural birth. We're born into it through spiritual birth. And we are adopted by the grace of God into this family. None of us deserve to be in God's household, do we? When you think about a household and you think about maybe a nice home, one of the things that this Alice Plutek said is that when she thought about her dad's life, she thought, number one, she thought, you know, if this hadn't happened, then I probably wouldn't be here and certainly wouldn't be the person I am. But then she thought a little bit of sadness because her dad was supposed to grow up in a more wealthy family, but he actually grew up in a very poor family, spending most all of his childhood in state-run orphanages in the early 1900s. She said he had a very hard childhood, only receiving an orange for Christmas each year. She said, I thought, Dad, because of the switching at birth, ended up having a very difficult life when he would have had a very privileged life. You and I, we've been adopted. Even though we should be having a very difficult and a very ultimately a abandonment to hell, to be cursed and to be damned to hell. But God has adopted us. He's brought us into his family. He's lavished, the New Testament says, his grace upon us. In Romans chapter 8, verses 14 through 17, it says, "The Spirit himself bears witness." In verse 14, excuse me, it says, "For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons. We've been adopted, and God has given us his spirit, and we cry, Abba, Father. And the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, and heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ." What a wonderful thing. I was reading something that talked about this relationship and the loyalty that Christ expected. And it said that in the Greek and Roman cultures of the time of Christ, family loyalty was extremely high. One author wrote, "The tightest unity of loyalty and affection in the ancient Mediterranean world was experienced in the sibling group of brothers and sisters," which is strikingly different than our culture today or Western culture. When you think about what Jesus was doing, and you think about what I read earlier in Matthew chapter 10 and Matthew chapter 12, what Jesus was doing is he was calling people to leave and maybe even to create a division within their own family group, the most important group that every person knew of the first century. He's saying, leave your group. But he never says, leave your group and be a lone ranger, just simply a disciple of Christ. No. He says, leave your group. And your group may not like that. In fact, it may separate father against son and mother against daughter, and it may divide you. But when you leave this group, you're going to be a part of the family of God. His intentions was always to create, I've come to build my church, my assembly. He's come to build his group, his family. And then, and this is the key thing, and it's the challenging thing for us, is that that group is to take priority over even our biological family group. That it's the family of Christ. Those who do the will of God are my mother, my brothers, and my sisters. You see, we prioritize and we love our church family. And so when we think about God's family, it's important to understand then how you identify yourself shapes your beliefs. How you identify yourself shapes your beliefs. So if you don't think of yourself as really being committed and as a part of God's family, but rather in a more individualistic way, in a more consumer way, as a more typical culture way of, well, I'm just going to go to church here, or I'm going to attend here, then it's much different than what Christ is teaching us. Christ is saying that when you become a Christian, you're born again and you're added to the family of God, and that you have relationships with other Christians and you're supposed to be a one another people. And that you are to prioritize those people and love them and care for them. For example, when we think about what this means, it means that we're supposed to, in 1 John chapter 3, 16 and 8 through 18, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us. And listen to this. We ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. We ought to lay down our lives for brethren. We ought to love one another, that we're willing to give our lives and care for our brothers. For if anyone has this world's good and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? One of the key traits of the New Testament church is that they physically took care of one another. They were sharing and giving of their resources. Acts chapter 2, Acts chapter 4, Paul collecting the collection for the Jewish people during the famine. They were giving to one another. You see, we ought to love each other in such a way. When we think about these comments, I think about how many people are living in a world today where there's so much social media interaction and there's so much lack of real intimate personal interaction. The family is struggling. Our biological families are often separated from one another, often by miles and distance. Often there's relationship problems, and divorce is such a big problem in our culture. Reminds me of this quote I read on Facebook from a fellow preacher. He said, as more and more of our interactions become virtual, I believe the weekly church gatherings will be more and more appreciated by discerning Christians. There's no digital replacement for a warm embrace, a shoulder to cry on, a song sung with friends, or bread broken with family. So true that our identity must be shaped by that we're a part of the family of God. We're a part of the family of God, and we're born into that family, and it takes priority. Now, when you think about this concept, what does living with this concept mean? All of us understand our physical family. Everybody has lived in a physical family, haven't you? You were raised in one, and you have one now. Now, that means that we ought to understand a few things about what God means by this analogy. And there's some common denominators across family lines in the Bible and also in our own experience. And those common denominators involve a couple things. First of all, family is something that we understand in the Bible, and we understand, generally speaking, in the world, that we need to have a loyalty and commitment to. But we also understand that every family, the one you grew up in, the one you live in now, and the one you visit at family reunions, and it's real apparent, has problems, right? And there's common similarities. There's the black sheep of the family. There's the one who there tends to be maybe in the family, we know what to talk about, what we don't talk about. We know the issues from the past that we don't bring up. We know the struggles that have been there. Every family has them, and every family's going to have them. There's conflict in families. There's people who have chosen to leave the family. There's people who are coming back to the family. There's people who are new to the family. There's people who are trying to bring the family together. And there's other people often who may be trying to harm the family. And in the Bible, for example, in the book of Genesis, we see all kinds of examples of family. And God chose the analogy of a family, I think, significantly to say that His church is a family. Because we should be able to understand that what it means to be in a family. And one thing I think that we often need to understand is that what living in a church family is like is it's very similar to living in our physical families. And that is, there are unique individuals. There are histories. There's tension sometimes. There's disappointments. There's excitement. There's a need for forgiveness. There's a need for rejoicing. There's a need for celebration. That there's also a constant changing and moving forward, as well as always looking back and gaining from the past. Just like a family is always changing and is developing and is maturing and going through different processes from one generation to another generation and on to the next generation. That's how the family of God is. It's made up of individuals, unique in each one's ability. It's made up of people who sometimes we weep when they leave the family. We rejoice when people are new to the family and they're immersed into Christ. We sometimes have tension in the family. And we also want to do everything we can when someone is struggling in the family to encourage them and love them. Or if a sheep leaves the fold, to go and try to restore them to the family. But the church is a family. And I think one thing that we learn from this illustration, and we learn from God calling us a family, is that we shouldn't act surprised. We shouldn't act surprised or overly disappointed when the church, as God's family, is, like other families, not always perfect. You see, when we think about this idea, we need to understand that we've got to love each other like family. Now, when you hear that expression, some people think, well, I don't know if that's such a good thing in my family. Well, let me qualify that. We need to love each other like the Bible teaches family to love each other. We need to love each other the way God wants family to act. In a way that views one another and identifies yourself as, I'm a part of God's family. I'm a part of the Seven Oaks church family. And that means I don't just quit or give up on the church. And I don't quit or give up on my brothers and sisters. That means I have obligation to them. And I'm responsible for the work that goes on there, because that's the family's job. That's the family's work. It's like Marty said in his announcement there, that if you see something needs done, then let us know, or take care of it yourself, because you're a part of the family. You have responsibilities. You're in the family. And all of us are in the family that are a part of the church. And your identity should come from that. And your identity should be that I am a Christian, and I'm a part of God's family. I have a Father in heaven. I have an older brother named Jesus who intercedes for me, and I have the Spirit who indwells me. I am in God's household. And what a blessing it is. And I'm a part of His church. And so we need to be a family that lives like Romans chapter 12 teaches, where Romans 12 talks about the kind of family love that should exist. He says, verse 9, let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly, notice that's family, affection. Love one another. Outdo one another in showing honor, bragging on each other. When one family member does well, we're all proud of them. We brag on one another. We outdo one another in showing honor and encouraging them. We're not jealous. Do not be slothful in zeal. We're working for the family. The family needs something, then we want to pitch in and do it for the family. It's our family responsibility. And by the way, every person in the family, whether you are older or whether you're young, you are contributing to the family. And the family's not whole if you're not a part of it. Don't you? Isn't it sad when you go to a family event and for whatever reason, one relative that you really love and wanted to be with wasn't able to come? Maybe it's a Thanksgiving or Christmas or something, and because of other things, they just could not make it that year. You miss them. It's really sad, isn't it? When you realize that a family member is never going to be back because they passed away that year. You know, when I think about our family, when I think about the family of God, I realize that, and I want you to realize that the family's not just here. Family's also those who have gone on in heaven, and they're like Hebrews 12 talking about, they're surrounding us and encouraging us, and they're like that great cloud of witnesses encouraging us on. But the family of God is not just what we see here. The Seven Oaks family is not just what we see here. It's those even who have gone on, who we love, and they still are giving us an example, and they're still giving us a legacy, and they're still encouraging us by the life they lived. And we want to go and be with them. That's our family. See, that's the family that we have. A family that does what Romans talks about here, rejoices in hope, verse 12, patient in tribulation and constant in prayer. It's a family that is contributing to the needs of the saints and seeks to show hospitality. It's a family that in the church where we're hospitable to one another. We have open homes and open hearts. And let me say this. We say this numerous times, but I really want to emphasize it. If you have a need physically or spiritually, then the family wants to meet the need, but we can't meet the need if we don't know the need. So share with us your needs. And it doesn't mean it always has to be public. It doesn't mean I have to know or the others have to know. It might be you talk to another brother or sister and share that need with them. The church needs to be a safe place, a place where you can come to have your burdens met and laid down upon. A place where you know you'll be loved, where you'll be accepted, where people will care for you. He says, verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep. And then verse 16, live in harmony with one another. It's family talk, isn't it? You might need to read that at some family reunions or some family Christmases sometimes. But we need it in the church. Live in harmony with one another. You got to get along in the family. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Don't just look for the powerful, the ones you think are influential, and hang around with them, but look for the person who's doesn't seem to be very connected. Look for the person who might be the widow or the widower, or the newcomer, the single mom. Look for them. Look for the lowly and minister to them. Look for the ones that may not be up front or may not be in the leadership. Look for those families. Think about it. Have they been here in a few weeks? Maybe I could send them a card. What are they going through? Think about them. He says, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Don't think you have all the answers in the family. Understand that it's a collective wisdom of the family. And we've got to work for the overall good of the family. I've heard it said that, like John F. Kennedy talked about when he challenged our nation to think about not just what the nation can do for you, but what can you do for the nation? Think about the church and the family. It's not just what the church does for you, but what can you do for the church? What can you do for the church? You see, living with the concept of the church as a family means so much. It means we love and care for each other. It means we hurt, we struggle. It means that we don't want people to leave the family. And it means we want people to come back to the family. It means we are safe and loving. It means that it's better than any physical family on earth, I believe. I am closer to many people here, and I believe many of you are closer because we see each other on a daily basis than we are much of our own physical family who live off. Maybe even live close. It's our spiritual family. In the paradigm of the New Testament, it's God, church, and family. That's what Jesus is saying. Our spiritual family should take priority. Not that we neglect our physical family. We understand we have a responsibility to that, and the Bible talks a lot about that. But he's saying that you got to understand you're a Christian, and your loyalty comes to Christ and putting Him first. And so don't put a standard on the church that God never put on the church. God understood that we're going to be like family. We're going to have our struggles. We're going to have our challenges. Don't look at the church and say, well, I'm not going to be a part of that because they're not perfect. Your family's not perfect, but you're a part of it, aren't you? And you love your family. The church isn't perfect, but it's God's family. Love it. Make it better. You see, that's God's purpose. As we close, one of the greatest ways to perpetuate family closeness and strength is to tell stories about family. And think about family and to strengthen family bond. This is great. Church has a lot of great stories, and we need to share those with newcomers and talk about the legacy of the past and the hopes of the future. But I want you to think about what's your story. Maybe you haven't done a DNA sample and figured that out. And hopefully, if you do, you won't have any great surprises like Alice had. But you know, your identity shapes your beliefs. Your identity shapes your beliefs. Do you identify yourself as a Christian, as a part of God's family? If you do, then it should impact how you relate to your brothers and your sisters, how you relate to God, and the obligation and responsibilities that you have as an individual. You see, I don't want you doing and living your whole life like these two men did, having the wrong identity of who they are. I want you to know who you are in Christ, so you can live out the purpose God has for you in His family. Do you identify yourself as God's family? Our church wants to be and determines to be God's family. Won't you join us in that pursuit if you're not a part of it? If you are a part of it, then remind yourself of what the family of God looks like and the responsibilities you have toward your brothers and sisters. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, if you want to put Christ on in baptism, then please come as together we stand and as we sing.